Hello and welcome to another episode of Climate Matters and a further interview with one of the mayoral candidates for the Nelson Tasman area. I'm Lindsay Wood, I'm Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and today we're going to be interviewing Tasman mayoral hopeful Mike Harvey. So let's get started with Mike's first question, which relates to the rate of decarbonisation of our economy. Well, it's lovely to welcome mayoral candidate for Tasman, Mike Harvey, here. It's 4 years since the IPCC 2018 special report signalled a decarbonisation trajectory of 7.6% year on year from 2020 to be compatible with 1.5 degree C global warming limit. It's 3 years since our Zero Carbon Act legislated for commensurate responses. But with subsequent lack of effective action, plus regional growth, that is now close to 10% reduction every year. If elected mayor, what would be the key strategies you would put in place to optimise your community's chances of successfully decarbonising at such a formidable rate and on an ongoing basis? Over to you.
To effectively achieve the decarbonisation at a rate that we need to, Lindsay, I think first thing we have to do is we actually have to engage the people, you know, and the people have been a bit disengaged. And there's a lot of talk about, like, if we had buses, you know, people would ride free. But you can put on free buses and people still don't ride, you know. The people have to be motivated, and we need to motivate the people and inspire the people. And see, there's been a real thought process around green for so long now that it's just expensive. It's just too expensive to do green. You know, so we need to, I think we need to start pairing up with some companies that are leading, you know, leading in the technology fields and actually bring them to Tasman, give them a reason to come to Tasman, give them a reason to, you know, install new product in Tasman, use it as a show town, you know, offer developers incentives and include them as serious considerations in the planning discussions. Don't just put them in there as some sort of, like, you know, lip service, because that's what I feel they've been put in as a pass. You know, we hear them. I personally, I do property development. I wanted to put a turbine in into a 15-lot subdivision. I wanted to put a turbine into the stormwater system and feed it back in. And it was more problem than it was worth. You know, anyone would have thought that I wanted to build the Taj Mahal, you know, and have the complexities of that. And that's the challenges. We need to encourage people. We need to encourage people, and council needs to be open to it. And I don't think council's been legitimately open to it. I think they've been outwardly, politically, correctly open to the idea of green, but in truth, they're not. They haven't been. Mm-hmm. They're not receptive and they're not responsive, and they're in the mindset that it's too expensive. So, Lindsay, I think it's about getting reframing the thinking of everybody, the council and the community. And I think we have to think at a community level. We've got to stop thinking about the planet, and we need to start thinking about the Nelson Tasman province and what difference can we make here. And that's the key. Stop worrying about the bigger picture. When you look at it in an elephant, it seems really daunting. If you think about doing it one bite at a time, it seems achievable. We just need to work on Tasman.
Thanks for that, Mike. Now we'll go on to question number two, which is concerned with our energy future.
We're among the most energy profligate societies in history, and much of our greenhouse gas emissions comes from fossil fuels, with transport emissions around 94% of individual emissions in our region. Decarbonising our energy sector is a key to decarbonising our economy, but the logistics are daunting. Electrification of almost everything, New Zealand being especially vulnerable to key global supply chain issues, and the net energy gain of all renewable energy sources, except good hydro, being inadequate to sustain our society in its present form. Mike, what do you think the energy future of the region will look like in 25 years, and what would you advocate to prepare our region to make the most of that energy future?
I think there's a few myths that live in amongst the whole green thing, and it comes back to this thinking that it's really expensive. One of the things we should do is we talk about the Southern Link, and we talk about, like, the motorways going into Richmond, Nelson, you know, those motorways there. Well, It's just not feasible for people to have like a bus route to go down and all those things. But imagine if you had like just a very short rail track that just took you from a park and ride in a dead straight line straight into the middle of town, backwards and forwards, all the time. Just, I'm talking about only like 1K. We always think about we have to build like the biggest thing. We have to build the biggest thing and it's going to save the planet. Well, if we just started thinking, like, we'll just build 1K to a park and ride, but we'll just take it down past Berryfields and we'll just have it zooming straight in from down there and we'll have a park and ride. So all the people that work in Richmond want to be in Richmond, they want to hang out in Richmond. We can then get the all the fossil fuels out of the centre of town, which will be better from a benzene's point of view, just floating around, people will feel better. The town centres will feel better. And imagine having a high-speed little train, just tram, just over a K, just running backwards and forwards. So those types of solutions to me, like, they're the sort of solutions that aren't overly expensive, really, when you boil down on them. And I think they could make a really big difference to people just sitting in their traffic lights at Queen Street, chugging fuel through their exhaust system, waiting for the lights to turn green. It's quite bad. You know, one person in the car for another. But I get it, Lindsay. I get it because I do it, you know, and we all do, because there is no other solution which works. And this is the point. Green solutions in the past, which is the myth I was talking about, not only have they been considered, you know, not cost effective, they've also been considered less effective and not quite as good, you know. And we just need to make people realise that those little solutions, if we tailor those around how the communities work and how the community functions, then I think we can fit them into our lives really easily and we can make a real difference just here in Tasman. And that's where we need to make a difference.
So the next question, Mike, is a just transition. There's a sardonic joke about sea level rise that the poor get moved and the rich get seawalls. While expert Belinda Story would suggest that might not do the wealthy much good either, the real point is that disadvantaged people normally become even more disadvantaged as the result of upheaval or crisis. In a climate context, there is frequent reference to striving for a just transition, but global evidence suggests that is largely an unfulfilled aspiration. If you were elected mayor, what would you like your legacy to be in the area of a just transition and climate responses, and how would you go about achieving that?
Absolutely, Lindsay. This is one that's actually pretty dear to me. As you know, I've been in property for over 20 years, owned real estate companies and done property development, built houses and spec houses and all those things. So I was brought up on an orchard in this region. And one thing we always had on the orchard was we had accommodation for seasonal workers, you see. And as a child, it was just what happened in our family, you know, from Christmas through to sort of like the start of winter. We had transient workers in all the time. We had a lot of local workers who were seasonal, who lived in Mapua and sort of Tasman-type locations. They were more your full-time staff, you know, and then you had your on-site accommodation. Well, you know, one of the things you talk about, you know, more disadvantaged, and Miss Molyneux, I believe it was, made reference to, you know, when someone owns a house, they feel better, they feel more grounded. So we're having a problem attracting seasonal staff, and we have enough seasonal work to keep people going all year round. So, like, you know, they can go from one seasonal crop to another to sheds and carry on. So, but what we've done is a lot of the orchards and the orchard accommodation has been subdivided off and sold to wealthy people who want to live in the country, and that's great because, yeah, you know, I probably identify with that to some degree now as well after a lifetime of hard work. But the reality is it's taken away the orchardist's opportunity to actually have on-site accommodation. Well, if we created an environment where we partnered up with orchardists and they took a piece of their property, which was close to a service infrastructure, like a main road or something, and we worked with them and created, say, 8 lots, and we reduced the development contributions and that, and they could sell them to workers coming from out of town. We could promote those as, you know, as opportunities in Nelson to own houses and get seasonal work, and we could bring those people into town. They could have the houses, and the orchardists would get the workers, people would get into housing ownership, we'd grow our community positively. You know, this is the type of creative thinking that the council needs to adopt to address this question. Because I've been on both sides of that fence, Lindsay, you know. Mm. I know the importance of the orchardists. And if as a council, we, you know, just between, you know, like if we worked with the orchardists in a partnership and created like 8 or 10 lots in a little community, like, you know, like a little place which was well serviced, So it didn't cost the council a lot to service it. And we could implement a lot of green technology into there. So we could use green technology to manage the human waste. We could recirculate stormwater through filters and stuff, which the council's never been wanting to consider. And that would make it cheaper, actually, to create a 10 or 15 lot settlement in the corner of a or between three orchardists, you know, on a piece of land between three orchardists. And it would bring seasonal work, it would bring life, it would be positive because they would have ownership of the land. So I think it's a really exciting type of proposal. And that's only one idea. I'm not saying that's what I'm going to do. I'm not running on that platform. It's just one idea that I've got. And I think the whole idea is bring all of the ideas to the table and seriously consider them. That's what I'm saying. Stop just paying lip service to them and seriously consider the ideas and start listening to people.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Awesome. Question four is on the cost of climate initiatives. In reports dealing with climate-related initiatives, there are often comments such as a particular course of action is not cost-effective or not making economic sense, and yet there is almost never reference to the time frame being considered and almost never comparisons with the cost of not taking action, which specialists like Lord Nicholas Stern highlight are generally orders of magnitude greater. And this is often exacerbated by the imbalance of higher upfront costs being needed to realise longer-term benefits. Over what timescales do you think the costs and benefits of climate actions should best be evaluated? And if you were elected mayor, how would you reconcile the often unresolved conflict of prioritising funds now for the benefits over a much longer term?
Well, I think this is an interesting question, actually, Lindsay, because, you know, it deals with the two things that I've said already earlier on, which is I think there's a couple of fallacies that exist around, you know, around green technology. And, you know, those fallacies are that it's too expensive and it doesn't work properly. And, you know, and when you inject into the answer here that green technology works equally as good and is just as cost effective as the other technology, then it takes the need for this question away. And I think that's the thinking we need to shift. So to answer this question, I mean, I see the timeframes that we need to measure the implementation of our region's growth against is the timeframe that the planet's going to give us before it self-destructs. And so that means we have to start now. And, you know, 500 years, you know, we have to look way out. There's no point just looking to tomorrow. We've got to take some drastic action now. And I feel that the technology's there, there's a wave building, and you know, I'm a capitalist by nature. I love growth. Mm. The reason I'm running for mayor is because I've just had enough of the mediocrity and the unwillingness to actually stand up and be counted for us as a region. That's another story. The thing is that I believe we need to start injecting serious green solutions into our planning programs. And that's not even about time. Like I say, time will be determined by what we do, you know. Mm. And so we have to have a very long view.
Great. Okay. Kindly now imagine that you've been gifted a magic climate strategy wand. If your candidacy is successful and you could conjure up any other single climate-focused council strategy you wished, please tell us what it would be and why you see it as important.
Well, Lindsay, interestingly enough, having now listened to your podcast, so I've been blown away by the depth of expertise we've got in the region. You know, to be frank, you know, as a ratepayer doing what I do and stuff, you know, I haven't really been exposed to that. It's been, you know, it's been stunning. And we've got some real progressive thinkers in the area, and I think that the key lies with them in the first instance. I think that that what we need to do is, I'm not into working groups. I can't cope with working groups, sitting around drinking coffee, daydreaming, wondering what you're going to do. Everybody knows. Everybody that knows me knows that I just get things done. Like, I just get on and do things. And like, that's been the story of my whole life. So I couldn't bear to have a working group. But what I do like to do is I do like to learn. And I do like to hear. And I do like to know what's available to us. And I'd love to have an environment at the council where we could put together those people in your podcast and we could put their heads together. And we could charge them with the responsibility of quickly, and I'm talking about like over a couple of weeks, coming up with a sort of a strategy that we can look at, you know, to start implementing seriously good green technology and show and demonstrate. And they could look around and tell us. They probably know. Between them, they would know. You know, and really the point is that none of us is as clever on our own as all of us together. And so that's the thing, is to hear what people have got to say. As far as my own views go on what we could do, I believe we've got an ongoing crisis with stormwater. And as we speak today, Lindsay, you know, Nelson's just been decimated by flooding. Mm. So I have been saying for a long time, and it's not about me, it's just about my children and the future. So I can't even bear the word I. The reality is, though, we have a stormwater crisis. And the biggest part of the crisis in the stormwater is that when that stormwater falls on the streets and washes down the drains, yeah, it floods our houses and it washes away our streets. But you know what it does also? Is it takes plastic into the ocean. And that plastic is sort of building up around the Galapagos Islands, and it's just like there's these massive big plastic farms floating around in the ocean. And it's disgusting. And we're washing our streets. We're literally washing our streets into our oceans. So, you know, fact is us as a human species, like, we get our things washed away. That's terrible. We need to be better at managing it because we're washing stuff into the ocean, which is impacting the other people that share the planet with us. And so my view is that we need to tidy up the stormwater. That's where it all lies. Because, see, if we tidy up the stormwater and we get to just outside of Richmond somewhere and we build some really big capture tanks and we capture all of that plastic and all of the stuff and all of the stormwater from all the houses and we capture it all and we filter it and we feed it back to the town, then we've got a closed circuit. And that's what they're doing in really progressive countries around the world. We've got three national parks on our doorstep. There's not, I don't believe there's a capitalist or a lefty greeny in this region that doesn't love our national parks and love the Marlborough Sounds and love the Golden Bay and love the relationship we have with nature. So I think, you know, even the wealthiest people in this town are fully immersed in that. That's why they live here. So I think that they would also embrace the idea that we started becoming an eco-village of the future. So the Tasman District set the way to become an eco. And I don't want to do this at the cost of, you know, of business and farming, because I come from a farming background. My uncle's owned farms, my dad owns farms, brought up on farms, and my friends are farmers. I believe farmers, as I say on my website, it's time to stop blaming farmers and fossil fuel. Yes, fossil fuel contributes to a huge amount in this region, and I appreciate that. But the reality is that it's not just farmers, it's all of us. And all of us need to look at the solution of, like, stopping washing all that out, feed the water back, and create it for the rest of New Zealand to admire. The biggest point for me is that we need to start to recognise that the old understanding of green technologies is not necessarily the new understanding of green technologies, but we've got our old thinking, you know. And there's just a great story by Zig Ziglar. His wife said, go and get the Christmas ham. So he went and she said, don't forget to chop the knuckle off the ham. Get the butcher to chop the knuckle. And he went and he came back and he hadn't chopped the knuckle off the ham. And his wife said, why didn't you get the knuckle chopped off the ham? And he goes, well, what does it matter? It fits in the pot. So he puts in, she goes, no, it does matter. And so they ring grandma to find out why she always had the knuckle chopped off the ham. And she said, because it wouldn't fit in my pan. And you see, and like, they thought it was something to do with something, but the truth was that it was just a historical belief.
Very simple reason, and they attributed it with a lot more significance than it really merited.
And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And so education is, you know, and I'm not interested in this education, radio campaigns, blah, blah, blah. Talk about real tangible education where people understand what's going on. Proper education, straight to the point. No, all this mucking around business.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. It was great to get your views and answers to the questions we posed. Thanks for participating, and good luck in October. Now, as always, I will give you details of how you can listen to podcasts, all the different podcasts. Your best bet is to go to www.resilience, that's R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-Z, resilience.co.nz, and there you'll find links to our podcast page, which will have a whole lot of links again to all the different expert and mayoral podcasts. And on that note, I thank you for your company. I do hope we enjoy it again for other podcasts. And as always, kia kaha for the climate.